Brenham. Whilst on Radio 4 FM, it's time for the Book of the Week. Penny Downey reads A Long Walk Home, Judith Tebbutt's account of her terrifying ordeal at the hands of Somali pirates after being kidnapped from a holiday in Kenya. In today's episode, after weeks of clinging to the hope that her husband David has been working to secure her release, Judith finally gets a phone call from home.
It was a Saturday, the 1st of October, and I was sitting on a chair facing the door, a walk just completed. The navigator rushed into the room waving a phone. At his back, just about every other pirate in the compound came piling in. "What on earth's going on?" I asked the navigator. He grinned and thrust the phone at me. "I have your son on the phone." It was as if my heart had missed a beat. "Hello? Ollie, hello?" The man who I'd come to know as the negotiator spoke first. "You had 3 minutes, no more." The line clicked and buzzed. "Hello? Ollie? Is that you?" "Mum, yes, it's Ollie." There was so much to say, and yet I could barely speak. Ollie sounded full of urgency. "Listen to me, Mum. I can't speak for long. This has to be short. And there are some things I have to ask you. Are you ill? Do you need medical attention?" "No, darling. I'm okay. I'm being treated well." "Have they given you bottled water?" "I've got that, yes." "Have you got a pen and paper, Mum?" "No, they haven't given me that." "Do you have a routine? Something you do every day?" "I do, yes. I'm walking around the room every hour." "That's good, Mum. Stick to the routine. Routines are good. Keep walking. You're walking to freedom. Now listen, Mum. We're trying to get you home. The family is doing all we can. You're just going to have to be strong." Then I heard the line cut out, and that's it. Over. The negotiator was back. I could feel my hand trembling. Alone again, back to my walking, I replayed my and Ollie's brief exchanges in my head incessantly. He had sounded so much in control, focused, and mature. But where was David? And Ollie hadn't mentioned him, which was, on reflection, strange. But I would hear from my son soon. I felt my very sanity depending on it. Later that day, I saw Ollie's questioning yielding results when one of the young pirates entered my room bearing a little assemblage of items for me. A thick exercise book, a pen, a packet of tissues, and a slim battery-powered torch. The following afternoon, the navigator came in bearing the leader's red phone like a totem. Once again, the room filled with eager pirates. The navigator, the leader, and Marvin perched themselves on the edge of my bed as if affirming their seniority. All of them were grinning and giving me the thumbs-up sign. "Mum, it's me." "Hi, Ollie, darling, how are you?" "Mum, we've only got 3 minutes, but listen. We're still working on getting the money." "And where's Dad, Ollie? How is he? How is he coping with this?" "Mum, there's something I have to tell you. Dad didn't survive his injuries." In my head, in my heart, it was as if a clock had stopped.
"Injuries? What do you mean, injuries?"
"He was trying to protect you, Mum. He was brave to the very last minute. No, it just wasn't possible."
"Ollie, are you telling me Dad is dead? Is that what you mean?"
"I'm so sorry, Mum." The navigator muttered something to Marvin, but loud enough for the rest of the room to hear. Sharp intakes of breath, mouths opening, eyebrows raised. Ollie's voice filled my head. "We've just got to remember all the good times we had with him." Some of the pirates were getting up and making their way out of the room. "I love you, Mum. I need you.
I need you to get through this, to stay strong. It's just a matter of time, Mum. We'll get you home. The instant I heard, home, the line went dead and the negotiator's voice returned. That's it. No more. Did you hear that? I said to him, trying to force my voice through the fog in my head. Hear what? My husband is dead. You killed my husband. Who tell you your husband dead? You were listening, weren't you? My husband's dead. And you have got to get me on a plane out of here tomorrow because I need to be with my son. You've got to fly me home tomorrow. I have got to get back to see my son. We will check that out tomorrow and we will start negotiations. The grunt had gone beneath me. I looked around the room and I jabbed a finger from one face to the next. You, and you, and you, all of you, you killed my husband. I was staring hardest of all at the navigator and Marvin and the leader still sitting on the corner of the bed. The leader, the last man to see David alive, looked back impassive. He was the man David had struggled with. It had to be him. I looked at him hard, and he looked back. I would not let him stare me out. Finally, he got to his feet and sauntered out. Dawn found me alone again. Numb. Emptied. Desolate. When food came, I couldn't bear to look at it. All I wanted was news that I would be flown home, that some sense of shame had overtaken the negotiator and Fat Man. But nothing happened. Nothing changed. I sat down and wept. After a while, I realized I was making a disturbance. The navigator came in.
Why you cry?
Why? You know why.
Maybe you get new husband. When you go home, you will look for a new husband?
No, I will not, I said quietly.
Yeah, it's no problem. Your husband dead, you go home, get another husband.
No, no way. I don't want another husband. Wanting to hear no more, I put my face in my hands and wept.
I got up and I walked because I felt I had to. There was no alternative. Otherwise I would curl up, cry, lose hope. You're going to go on for as long as you have to. Pull yourself together. So I made an inward vow that I could permit myself only brief and controlled interludes of sorrow. I found myself pushing aside thoughts of my loss to focus on the dullest practical matters, a kind of lateral thinking. How am I going to manage our household alone? What will it mean to cook for one person? Should I give up work? When my thoughts about David, about home, threatened to overturn me, I instructed myself inwardly, stop thinking about that now. It's not doing you any good. Think about your next walk. Think about that gecko climbing the wall. Not only thoughts, but people went into my mental filing cabinet. And David was filed to the very back, because I couldn't bear it otherwise. I knew my discipline wouldn't be watertight, and it wasn't. Sometimes the emotion just broke free, I couldn't ward it off. But I practiced, and practiced, and chided myself for lapses, and very slowly, I got better at it. All the anger and resentment I had felt towards my captors before I knew of David's death were as nothing to the hatred I now harboured for them. And this was a new feeling for me, disconcerting in its virulence. I had never hated anyone before. I didn't honestly recognise the emotion, much less that it could be so strong. And yet my logical mind told me an uncomfortable, undeniable truth. If I was going to get through captivity, if the days were to be manageable, I had to get along with them. I had to be methodical, businesslike, ensure that there were pirates I could deal with to whom I could make requests. More than ever before, I needed to know the time of day. So on one of the navigator's drop-ins, I asked him if he could get me a clock in order that I could time my walks properly. There and then he unstrapped the digital watch he was wearing, a black plastic digital, and handed it to me. My exercise book became another important measuring tool. I made a game of making lists, TV programs, artist names. If I were running a cake shop, what sort of wares would I bake? Angel cake, banana cake, cheesecake. I would write out an especially long word and try to make smaller words from the letters within it. Rage and sane seemed to recur with regularity. Amina continued to visit me whenever she called into the compound. We would bow to each other, shake hands. And yet, she had become a puzzle to me. For all the kind gestures she made to me covertly, I wondered how, as a woman, she could go on being a party to my imprisonment, knowing that my husband was dead and my son struggling to barter for my freedom thousands of miles away. I had to accept Amina was profiting from my captivity. It had to be a good earner for her. Was it one she couldn't say no to? My days felt changeless, interminably long and monotonous, hot, sticky, and unventilated. I walked on and on, barefoot, for half an hour on the hour from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., until I felt myself on the verge of collapse or the painful twinges of my blisters became unmanageable. Even then, I would try to walk on the edges of my feet, just in order to keep up with the program. When I wasn't walking, I counted. 170 sets of vertical patterns on the curtains round the room. 110 nails through the eyelets that kept the curtains hung up. The 9 nails on one leg of my bed. The 5 on the other. In this way, I served my time. One evening, a surprise. One of the pirates came into my room carrying a transistor radio, the most intriguing sight I'd seen in a while. "Ah, radio," I said. "Oh, yes, very good," he replied with a thumbs up. I had no idea what he was listening to, but that didn't seem to be the point. "BBC, very good, yes," he said. "BBC, World Service." "Oh, yes. World Service." I gave him the broadest smile. At that, he lifted the radio and began to fiddle with the tuning knob. Suddenly, an English-speaking voice broke forth, the familiar RP intonation of a nightly BBC newsreader. He handed me the radio with a look of triumph. I was amazed. "Not for me, no." "Yeah," he said, beaming. I sat and listened for perhaps half an hour to News Hour and then World Briefing, stunned by how the business of the great wide world was suddenly cascading into my narrow confinement.
And tomorrow, as conditions in captivity worsen, Judith fears for her own sanity as Penny Diney reads the next instalment of A Long Walk Home by Judith Tebbutt. The abridger was Miranda Davis and the producer was Justine Willett. You can also catch up on the Book of the Week via the Radio 4 website.